Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 27th of October. I'm Phil Carroll.
I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Charles Archer.
So coming at you from New York City. Amazing to be back out here. Cool city, despite now smelling like the inner sanctums of a major cannabis factory. How's everyone doing?
Yeah, good. How are you guys?
I'm good.
Very, very.
Are you enjoying your holiday, Phil, in New York?
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you've never been here before, anyone listening, it's a city where genuinely the best way of getting around is on foot. It's, you know, you forget the underground, forget taxis, because they're all just literally like snail's pace. Yesterday we did 35,000 steps. So I think we covered about 17 miles on foot. So very tiring. But yeah, what a great city. I mean, it's just phenomenal. There's so many different things to see. We went into Broadway to play tonight, the Book of Mormon, which was Trey Parker, the guys who created South Park, one of their, I think it's got 3 Tony Awards. So looking forward to that. Yeah, but some good food. Election crazy out here, literally. It is everywhere you go. You can imagine it's all Harris versus Trump. Harris leading by 6 points, according to the latest poll by Fox News. Obviously, the upcoming US election, could see Donald Trump returning to the White House. UK Labour leader Keir Starmer being advised to establish a working relationship with him if Starmer becomes Prime Minister. So what are your thoughts on the way things are going? I mean, is it big news out there at the moment?
Well, big news for us is the budget, obviously. I mean, it's on the 30th, so we're only 5 days away. And nobody has any idea what they're actually going to do. It seems to be that, you know, they're just pushing out ideas. And whatever sticks, that's what they'll go with. And then I think once the budget is done in the UK, we'll then, you know, have time to think about the US election. I do think, though, potentially, given how they've marketed this as the worst thing that's ever going to happen, the changes will actually be relatively minimal and everything will be fine. We might get a decent boost from the 31st onwards.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about that. I sent something to Kev last night. Starmer is facing, obviously, scrutiny over his definition of the of working people. Obviously ahead of that, but the Labour's first budget since 2010. So what do you make of that comment? I mean, I think he's kind of upsetting a lot of people. So working people with assets should be taxed heavily, effectively, is what he said in his latest. Yeah.
We're not working people, basically, because own our own limited companies. So therefore, we cannot possibly be working people.
I mean, what are we doing now other than really hard, grueling work, right? But I don't know. I mean, the thing is, for me, is where did the money to invest come from in the first place, right? It didn't come magic out of thin air. We worked for it. We earned it. And then it's kind of, I mean, the thing is, the problem is, it's a political problem because he's so incompetent. He reminds me a bit of Liz Truss in terms of his ability to say what he actually thinks. You'd think that, you know, someone who used to be a very highly paid lawyer would know how to say what he means. But for example, you could say, well, individuals who have enough money that they're earning that they can max out their ISA and max out their pension and take advantage of the enterprise investment scheme and have money left over on top, those people we might go after. But instead, what he's effectively implied is if you've got a fiver in your ISA a month, then you're rich and we must target you. He's just a disaster. I mean, you know, do we expect anything else?
How dangerous is that, Charles? Because it's like sort of what gives him the right to define and say, you're working people with assets, you know, you're going to be heavily taxed. I mean,
it's okay. You know, like, for example, I work 5-6 days a week. I work a lot. You guys do as well. I now derive some of my income from assets that are generating capital for me, right? I think that probably describes a lot of people listening. And yet, if I stop work tomorrow, a year or two from now, I'd be out of money. So at the end of the day, you know, the vast majority of working people are also people with assets. Yeah. And in fact, if you have a pension, that pension is almost certainly invested in stocks and shares. So you also have assets. If you own a house, you have assets. In fact, the only people who don't have assets are people with just cash, liquid cash in the bank, and that's it, which is almost nobody. So it's. I mean, the thing is, if he wanted to say, look, I'm a Labour politician, and I believe that the poorer people in this country have got the short end of the stick, so I have to tax the productive capital more in order to help them out because wages have grown so slowly, then that would be fine. But he's not said that. What he said is if you happen to be able to write a check to get out of trouble, you know, like, I can't remember the last time I wrote a check. I think you can't think of anything that's, you know, less out of touch than that.
But the scenario is that I mean, this is a game of political football, isn't it? Because they said they would not increase the tax burden on working people, and now it's come down to what is the definition of a working person, you know? So,
Well, they can't. Well, if they try to define a working woman, they'll be completely unstuck, won't they?
yeah, absolutely. Well, what about a working transgender person then? You know, it's
I
like.
don't know.
Well, what game are we going down? You know, the fact is, he's the prime minister. He should be turning around and saying, "This is what I'm going to do, and it's for the benefit of the country." If that is the case, does he believe that? I don't know. We will see.
We will see.
But
I'm not too worried about it. I mean, the
I think
only
he's going to increase. I mean,
capital
let's have a
gains,
raffle now. He's going to increase capital gains tax, or she's going to increase capital gains tax. For sure, I am absolutely certain. So, what do you think it's going to go to? Do you think it's going to go to 30%? Do you think it's going to go to 25%? Do you think it's going to go to, you know, do you think it's going to match our salary payments? You know, so in other words, it goes 20%, then 40%, then 45%. I mean, I think if they do that, they will destroy the markets
They
basically in the
will.
UK more so than they already have. And I think they've listened to that. That's why I've heard rumors then of, oh, we'll increase capital gains to 24, 25%. But there is a point where if you increase capital gains tax too much, you will actually get less money.
Yep, 100%.
Because people will just not invest in this particular thing because they have to give too much of it away.
Well, they either
So
leave. Yeah, sorry, Kev, they either won't invest, or if you're already holding shares, you'll just wait until a new government comes along with a lower capital gains rate and realize the gain then. It's an optional tax, it's optional when you choose to cash out. I mean, the other problem is, on the other side of the coin, is it might be the case that if you increase capital gains too high, people only invest in enterprise investment schemes and venture capital schemes, and then other segments of the market get no liquidity at all, even less than what we already have. But yeah,
Yeah.
it's there comes a point you put the tax up too much, you actually just make less. I think the Treasury analysis of capital gains has already said if you increase it, you will get less money out of the system. So I don't know why they would, but I'm sure they will.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's going to go up, but I don't think it's going to be a significant increase because I think maybe they've listened to that and they've actually realized, oh, common sense says let's not put it up too much.
Well,
You know,
it's
I don't know.
how much of this has ended up being leaked, because this has always been like people we see on groups saying, oh no, you can't comment until it's actually out there. But actually, we know from experience that a lot of this news that is leaked to the market through media channels, isn't it, to kind of soften
Yeah,
when it happens, you know.
it's designed, isn't it, to see, what sticks. They'll introduce lots of policies. Whichever one has the least goose hissing as you pluck our feathers, we'll go with that one. But it used to be, right, really not that long ago, that if you released policy early, you get fired, right? They track you down, they fire you. Now it's just, par for the course, and that's just kind of the way politics has been downvalued in the UK. But I think the other big problem is employer national insurance, because apparently this is not a tax on working people. But I guarantee you that when it comes to, getting your raise next year, if your employer's national insurance on your income has gone up, massively, you ain't getting one.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, Charles, we're going to find out on Wednesday anyway. It'll all be revealed at
And
obviously
then we'll be talking again next Sunday. It'll be like,
on.
okay, capital gains went up 1%, and that was it.
We better book 2 hours for next week's roast, haven't we? Because I think there's going to be a lot to talk
Yeah,
about.
maybe we should have a budget after budget roast next week, you know? So when the budget's announced, we
Well, even as it's
have a
announced,
podcast.
Well, I mean, I
That
imagine I'm trying to say it'll just be mostly editing out swearing. That's all, it'll be like an hour of just hate.
Could have a live Facebook or whatever it is, a
Then,
Zoom live. Join in for some banter around what she has to say.
Let's move on to our special guest this week. Today we have the pleasure of welcoming back a true stalwart in the investment arena, Rick Rule from Rule Investment Media. Known for his shrewd insights and a career spanning decades, Rick's investment expertise has guided many through the ebbs and flows of the market. Welcome back to the podcast, Rick. How's life treating you?
Life is good with the exception of a bad cold and a phone that won't stop. But, you know, truly, life is very, very, very good. It's nice to see a bid in some of the markets. It's nice to see the outcomes that we talked about the last time that we visited for some markets, speculative markets come true. So, on balance, life is great.
Absolutely. So I'm out in the US right now, and I don't know what it's like where you are, but it's certainly like election fever is hotting up. We've seen Kamala Harris with endorsements from the likes of Beyonce. We've seen Trump. They're obviously moving to Texas now. We've seen Trump obviously going to be appear on the Joe Rogan podcast. But I mean, I just want to get your thoughts on how you see the outcome of the vote on November the 5th affecting the markets. Will a Republican win be better for stock market or vice versa? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, with the caveat to begin with that I wouldn't vote for either of them in any circumstance. So take what I have to say with a grain of salt. Our country will react either way. I suspect that should Ms. Harris get elected, that 35% of the electorate will be appalled. I suspect that if Trump is elected, a different 35% of the electorate will be appalled. And I think if either of them get elected, 30% of the electorate will be appalled. So it's going to be interesting. I suspect that a Trump victory would be fairly well regarded on Wall Street because some of the alleged populist measures, particularly the populist attack on people who have succeeded in life, evidenced by the Democrats, play poorly on Wall Street and play poorly among the investor class. I think that people who are concerned about some of the overarching aspects of American policy would be concerned with a Trump election. I suspect that widespread fears of social chaos in the near term, in the event of the election of either candidate, are probably overblown. When I look at the problems that confront my country, what I see is too large government, government interfering too much with the lives of Americans, government debasing the franchise that freedom created. I look at a federal budget in deficit, well, in on balance sheet debt that exceeds $35 trillion, financed with a budget that's in deficit $2 trillion a year. In the mining business, if we're trying to fill in a hole, we don't keep digging, and we have off balance sheet liabilities, entitlements, Medicare, Medicaid, federal pensions, military pensions. The net present value of that number exceeds $100 trillion. Estimates as to the negative accretion, the amount by which the net present value deficit increases, range between 2 and 4 billion a year. That means if you add the increase in on-balance sheet liabilities to the increase in off-balance sheet liabilities every year, the increased deficit is larger than the gross federal revenues. And neither candidate has addressed that. Both candidates are engaged in a time-honored process of trying to bribe the electorate, trying to bribe various aspects of the electorate by stealing somebody else's money to give to them. They
Rick,
shall name it.
does that not make the United States of America officially insolvent?
I would suspect.
The statements you've just made.
I would suspect the prospectus that accompanies the sale of U.S. treasuries, if private standards were employed, in other words, if the SEC employed the same disclosure standards to treasuries as they apply to public debt, public company debt, that the promoters of federal treasuries would be guilty of a felony.
Could Elon Musk say Trump gets elected and Elon Musk is put in charge of government efficiency? And we know how he does efficiency, and we've seen what happened to Twitter. Do you reckon he could change things, or do you think it's just a figurehead position?
I think it's important that anybody who believes that Trump is going to reduce the size of government with Elon, I would ask them to read a book called The Triumph of Politics by David Stockman.
Very good.
For those people in your audience who aren't as old as me, which is most of your audience, David Stockman was in charge of the Office of Management and Budget during the Reagan years. And he described how the Reagan promise was bankrupt after 120 days, that politics got in the way of the narrative around the Reagan budget cuts. An interesting side note, David Stockman's qualification to head the Office of Management Budget was a degree in theology. And when we joked about that, he said there was nothing more important than prayer if you were involved in federal budgeting at the time. But I would ask anybody that has faith in the political process in terms of the nuts and bolts of derailing American politics that they read The Triumph of Politics by Stockman. It's available on Amazon.
Okay, then. Is gold going to keep going up then? In that
case? That was my next question.
Is it going to be a record? Really? Are we going to hit $3,000 plus?
I don't want to answer the question that way. What I've been telling people is that I personally own gold, physical gold, as insurance, not as an investment. I've been systematically buying gold since 1998. Since 2000, it's worked. The first year didn't work out so well. But when people ask me, Charles, when is the gold price going to move? I scratch my head in an old sage manner. And I say, in 2000, since 2000 to today, it's moved from $253 an ounce to $2,700 an ounce, 8% compounded. When's it going to move? For the last 24 years.
Yeah.
Can it go through 3,000? That's not why I own gold. I own it because I'm afraid it's going to go to 9,000 or 10,000.
Yeah.
And I hope I'm wrong. The set of circumstances that kicks off a gold bull market is the same set of circumstances I lived through in the 1970s. Pardon my jocular interest, English, pardon me, but that's a shitty circumstance.
Yep.
In the 1970s, in the United States, according to the government, not some cranky old libertarian, we debased the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar by 75% over 10 years.
Yep.
We didn't default on our obligations, which is to say some old geezer who expected to get $2,500 a month in Social Security got it. But the $2,500 only bought $400 worth of goods and services.
Yeah.
I think past is prologue. And in circumstances where you inflate away the net present value of communal obligations, you do it by the difference between the nominal value and the real value in terms of purchasing power of the currency. Historically, for 1,000 years, in every culture in the world that I know of, where that circumstance happened, gold protected its purchasing power. If then you believe, as I do, that we likely reduced the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar over 10 years by 75%, it isn't a real stretch to suggest that the gold price could go up threefold or fourfold. If the decade of the 70s is too dramatic for you, and I get that, at the beginning of the decade, the gold price was price controlled. So the move from $35 to $100 was probably a freebie, right?
Yeah.
Let's be less dramatic. Let's look back to the year 2000, the last time that we experienced reduced faith in the U.S. dollar. That was a much more subdued market. The gold price only went from $253 to $1,700, a sevenfold increase. The difference is that at the beginning of both of those periods, aggregate government debt to gross domestic product was below 40%. Today, aggregate government debt relative to gross domestic product is 120%. Can we push on a string again? Yes. There's just less string.
What about the situation where the actual debt in the US cannot be serviced? You know, because it gets to the point where the actual tax dollars that are coming in, even with this debasing that you're talking about, is not sufficient to fund, because you have to have a low interest rate in the US to cover that debt payment, surely.
What's that popular song? I think I'm Japanese. I'm turning Japanese. I'm guessing. By the way, I'm no economist. I'm a credit analyst. I suspect what happens in that circumstance, at least for a few years, is that they print the balance. the Japanese managed very low interest rates. It was in their interest, both in terms of servicing the government debt, which is twice GDP, but also in stimulating demand for Japanese goods by artificially depressing the wages of Japanese workers through the decline in purchasing power of the Japanese yen. And I guess that's the way out for the U.S. This year, it looks as though debt service on the on-balance sheet liabilities of the U.S. will consume between 21 and 25% of gross federal income. I'm laughing. It isn't funny. But I have to say I'm laughing. You don't hear a discussion of this from the Trump camp or the Harris camp. In fact, you don't hear very much of it from Americans. This is actually eerily similar to the period 1968 to 1972. Now, I must say, in 1968, I was still in high school, but I was beginning to be aware of the problem. And in 1968, incipient inflation was recognized across America. Gerald Ford had those, you guys are all too young to know this, but he had these whip inflation now stickers, wins. Well, we lost. But the point is that the realization among voters and taxpayers about the nature of inflation didn't reach popular consciousness for 5 years until 1972. We discussed inflation, but taxpayers and voters had come off 20 years of economic boom since the end of World War II. They were conditioned to think things just got better and better and better and better and better. They were trained to buy the dips. It wasn't until the gasoline price was up fourfold that the price of groceries was up threefold, until rents had skyrocketed. Look at the last 3 or 4 years. My government, I'll criticize your government later. my government believes, and they would have us believe, that the deterioration of the purchasing power of the U.S. dollar is measured by the CPI, which Ron Paul, of course, calls the CP lie. If you believe the government, the deterioration of the U.S. dollar is progressing at about 2.6% a year. The problem with that measurement is when it's inconvenient, it doesn't include food or fuel. If you had a full body camera on me, heaven forbid, you would see that food is important to me. And I like to fly and I like to drive. And the index is hedonistically adjusted, which is to say that the price of my computer is less important than the people who measure its description of its value. They assign a value to it. But the dumbest thing about the CPI is that it doesn't include tax, which is the largest household expense for most Americans. Now, Phil, I assure you, if I didn't have to pay the tax, I wouldn't bitch quite so much about the measurement, but I do. And I would ask your American listeners, when they consider the government's suggestion that the deterioration of the U.S. dollar is merrily proceeding along at 2.6%, to look at their own household expense over the last 4 years. What's happened to the price of gasoline? What's happened to the price of food? What's happened to rents? What's happened to health insurance? Mortgage interest rates have doubled in the last 18 months. I would suggest to you that the deterioration of the U.S. dollar, at least in terms of the basket of goods and services that I consume, is more like 7.5% compounded, which was precisely the experience that Americans had at the beginning of the 1970s. If the reality of inflation continues and the perception of reality follows the trajectory of the 1970s, there will be a time when the reaction is as violent as the reaction, and I don't mean physically violent, but the reaction will be as strong as the reaction that we saw in the decade of the 1970s. If that happens, I think that precious metals prices, among others, will surprise people to the upside. And I really, 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 truly hope I'm wrong.
Yeah. I want to bring you back to that comment you just made, Rick, about, you know, I'll have a go at your government, obviously the British government, because we've obviously seen the news. We're gearing up for the first Labour budget in like 14 years. Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, came out yesterday, basically. He's paving his way for a possible tax rise. He's trying to break it to people gently. But he basically said that those with assets are not working people. What do you think of those comments?
Well, I can't speak for all Brits that I know, but the wealthy Brits of my generation, I can assure you, worked very hard. I competed with them. And if they didn't work hard, I buried them. And there were plenty I didn't bury. So while I can't speak for the length and breadth of the English constituency, nor can I for the Americans, I would take issue with that. In fact, from a philosophical point of view, in my lifetime, most people who have made money by delivering value to others. Somebody buys a good or a service from you because they value that good or service more than they value the money that they use to acquire it. Ergo, the people who have made the most money are the people who have generated the most goods, the most services. Now, for those listeners of yours who are familiar with Pareto's law, the suggestion that 20% of the population generates 80% of the utility in any given task, and the fact that Pareto's law allows that 20% lip to be put through the same performance dispersal curve and conformably aligned, meaning that 4% of the population or 80% of the 20% of the 20 generate 80% of the 80, will understand that economic performance isn't uniform. The people who haven't delivered as much value often resent those that have. And rich or poor, smart or dumb, hardworking or lazy, all vote. A time-honored technique to mobilize people with grievances, which is most of society, is to vilify some other part of society. That's happening in our country. The Republicans are vilifying immigrants, saying that the border is a problem. I personally believe that if you denied illegal immigrants access to social spending benefits, that you'd only get workers, and it would be great for us to have them. Bernie Sanders and the other Cadillac communists on the left have taken to vilifying American achievers. There are these remarks, which I suspect are similar in Great Britain, where they're talking about the billionaires as a class. In fact, Bernie Sanders has gone so far as to say that the answer to America's fiscal problems is to increase the taxes on the billionaires. I don't know the skew of wealth in Great Britain, but the IRS suggests that the aggregate net worth of American billionaires is $5.6 trillion, pardon me. If you stole all their money, not increase their tax, if you stole all their money, you could run the government deficits, just the deficits, not the government, for 2 years.
Let's do it, Rick. Let's do it.
You need to ask yourself, are these pinko politicians immoral or unscrupulous? There's no middle ground. It has to be one or the other.
I was going with
stupid. No, I think you've got option three. Both. You've got option three, which is just stupid.
Well, enumerate, perhaps.
Rick, while we're on the conversation of taxation, and we've just talked about gold, what's your take on silver? I feel silver is very undervalued in terms of the overall...
The silver bugs are a lot of fun.
Yes.
I'm not one, but they're true manic depressives. When silver isn't moving, nothing is right with the world.
Okay.
And when silver is moving, they want to take out a third mortgage on their house to leverage up. I've made a lot of money being a pawnbroker to the silver bugs for 45 years. And by the way, I'm sympathetic, although I'm not one. My experience has been that precious metals bull markets are led by gold because they're led by a fear buyer, a buyer like myself who buys for insurance. In those circumstances, like 1970 or like 2000, where the narrative gains traction, where the gold price increases, and the increase in price validates the narrative for the generalist investor. When the generalist investor comes out into the precious metals markets, leadership changes from gold to silver. Don't ask me why, because I don't know. Maybe the lower unit cost, maybe because...
it's cheaper to buy a silver coin, isn't it, than it is to buy...
I don't know why it is. I just know that it is. And people have asked me, what are the subtle signs that you look for? You don't need to look for subtle signs because the stuff gaps. It just goes absolutely crazy. To me, the move in the silver price from $31 to $35 is inhaling and exhaling. I'm not saying that to say it isn't going to break out, but in my experience, when it breaks out, you get 100% gains in a year. You don't need, you know, some cranky old bald libertarian named Rick Rule to tell you it's breaking out. The signs are everywhere.
And what about the PGMs then, like the platinum group metals?
I'm cautiously bullish about them. The last real decline we had in PGM prices occurred in 1990, and it accompanied Russia needing money. When the Russians need money, they sell what they produce efficiently, which is almost nothing, but it does include nickel, chromium, and platinum group metals, as well as potash. And I suspect that we're in a period right now where Russia needs money, among other things. What really interests me in PGMs is that the narrative has turned negative. The big thinkers in the world will tell you that we are approaching the end of the internal combustion engine, which means that we won't need PGMs for catalytic converters. They failed to note that ICE, internal combustion engine sales worldwide last year, were up, not down. And I don't see, perhaps you can correct me if you're in London, I don't see spontaneous demonstrations of young people asking for more smog. So my suspicion is that demand for platinum group metals in air pollution abatement and in catalytic converters continues. Meanwhile, on the supply side, it's worthy to note that PGMs come from three places: South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Russia. If there were social and political challenges in any of the three, and I note that there are, you might have supply shortages. I'm not saying that you will. I'm saying that you might. What's unique about platinum group metals is that the goods that are fabricated from platinum group metals have extraordinary utility relative to the price of the input. It takes right now... about $125 US to supply the platinum for a catalytic converter that allows the sale of a $50,000 car. What do you think would happen to the finished price of the car if the platinum price doubled?
It wouldn't go up at all. It would be, wouldn't change.
Absorbed.
It would just be absorbed by the manufacturer.
If you had a supply problem due to social or political disruption in Russia, or if Russia ran out of inventory to sell, or you had a supply hiccup in South Africa, it would be easy to see PGM prices double. Now, notice I didn't say that was going to happen. I said it was a possibility. But let's look at one other thing. In South Africa in particular, the political policies of the ANC government are such that the mining industry thinks it faces either de facto or de jure nationalization. What this means is that the private sector miners can't invest very much capital, even sustaining capital, in their mining operations. And that means that they substitute labor for capital. Because the laborers can't employ much capital, because the miners can't put the capital in, they can't make much money. The mine workers, the underground mine workers, absolutely need real wage increases. And the mining companies really can't afford it. Metaphorically, between a rock and a hard place.
And I think we've seen PGM production decrease as well, especially in South Africa, because those mines are just not viable at this level. So you're seeing less and less production.
I don't know if you've been, other than Makapani, other than the big Anglo open cut, if you've been underground in one of those platinum mines in South Africa, they're horrific places. You have mine workers working in maybe 1 meter stopes, supported by wood timbers, and you hear them crack and splinter. You see workers operating a jackleg lying on their back in water. In Celsius 44 degree heat, and not getting paid enough to sustain their families, particularly families that are back in the ancestral homelands. These workers' wages have to go up, and the workers' wages can't go up because the mining companies can't afford or won't afford, as a consequence of ANC policy, either the sustaining capital investments or the new project investments that are necessary to employ the workers with the skills to make more money. It's a truly, truly ugly circumstance.
What if we move further south in and we change the metal now to talk about copper? What's your thoughts on copper? We've got Zambia, we've got the DRC, we've got Zimbabwe, we've got Botswana, we've got Namibia. All of those countries have copper belts in them.
Kevin, the copper business has been very good to me. Anytime somebody says copper, it elicits a smile from me, because it's probably treated me better than I deserve to be treated, having participated in a couple of nice copper discoveries in my life. We have, with the possible exception of me, underinvested in copper for about 30 years. And that means that our exploration pipelines and our development pipelines at today's copper prices are very, very, very stretched. We are living as a species off copper mines that sadly resemble myself, 70 years old and well past their prime. If you look at the major mines that produce copper in the world, the biggest mine in the US is Bingham Canyon, 150 years old. Grasberg, 65 years old. The newcomer, Escondida, 40 years old. It's not like you stand at the pit wall and throw in water and fertilizer and grow more copper. So no matter what we do, no matter what we do, we're going to have supply shortages. Whether we have price increases will be a function of whether or not we have a synchronized global recession or depression. You can have supply shortfalls if you have demand shortfalls and you don't get price action. But in the absence of a synchronized recession or a depression, I think 5 years from now, you're going to see sharply higher copper prices. And it's not just about data centers or electric vehicles. That's a very Western-centric view. There's 1 billion people on Earth that have no access to primary electricity. There's another 2 billion people on Earth who have access to intermittent or unaffordable electricity. And they all want to live like we do. That requires copper to generate the power. It requires copper to get the electricity to them. And it requires copper to use it. I'm a real copper bull. You guys probably know, but your listeners probably don't. In the last 30 years, the average mined grade of copper has declined from 1.5% to 0.5%.
And there are some mines in Chile that are running at like 0.2, 0.3% cutoff.
Absolutely. Well, there's a whole bunch of things we could say about copper. Political challenges in my country, in Arizona, copper country. There's a wonderful deposit called Resolution. 1.2 billion tons, I think, at last count. Discovered 30, 32 years ago. Grade is 1.5%, three times the average grade worldwide. That deposit's been in permitting for 26 years. When, as and if it goes into production, the upfront capital costs are probably going to be $10 billion. Think about the value proposition for the people who discovered it 32 years ago. Overcoming the $10 billion in capital expense and then overcoming the time value of money for 32 years.
Well, does this make the, the jurisdictions in Africa, the Zimbabwes, the Zambias, the Botswanas, better jurisdictions than in the US? Because you can get a mine up and running much, much faster with a lower capex, but you have regulatory issues. What are your thoughts?
Certainly, Robert Friedland has shown that when African politicians have an incentive to streamline regulation, they do it. I am old enough to remember the last copper boom that we had, when Zambia nationalized their copper industry. Congo nationalized their copper industry. The idea that that African economies are riskless with regards to populist politics is wrong.
Mm.
What is right about Africa is that the mineral endowment relative to the exploration maturity is such that if you're going to look for a tier one deposit, in other words, if you're going to assume the political risk, Africa is a wonderful place to be. Truly yeah. wonderful place to be.
Yes.
I think the point is that people who look like all of us, and this will get us some hate, so let's do it. People who equate political risk, let me put it differently. Caucasian people tend to tolerate political risk that they understand. So if their money is stolen by white people in English, according to the rule of law, through taxation, regulation, or tariffs, or royalties, it's somehow less gone than if it's stolen by more traditional methods in Africa. The truth is that the money isn't less gone. What attracts me about Africa is that most Americans, most Europeans don't understand the level of technical and labor sophistication that exists in Africa now. The skill sets of the population in Africa relative to the skill sets that existed in Africa 40 years ago when I went there, night and day different. Night and day different. And the level of exploration maturity compared to Europe or the United States is effectively nil. The Botswana copper belt, the extension of the Zambian copper belt, likely all the way into Angola,
mm-hmm.
the ability that we still have in Haut Katanga, and then back into central Congo, the Nubian Shield, in terms of exploration for tier one deposits, other than the Tethyan metallogenic belt, I think Africa probably is the place you have to be.
Yep. Well, I think in terms of, kind of mining investments you have in Africa, yeah, you've got a couple there, don't you? I mean, we were both in Alphamin, a couple of years ago, it's done really well. But I think the question is, for you, maybe you can't answer this, but there's a few, obviously, the Tin Explorer right next to Alphamin Room, which is, potentially going to do it again with the same team. But in terms, are there any explorers in Africa that you're looking at that you've invested in, kind of the smaller scale ones?
Oh, a range of them. I can't help myself.
No.
By rights, I shouldn't be a speculator at all anymore.
No, but you can't help it. You're like the rest of us.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I laugh because all the money I now invest conservatively, I made by speculating wildly.
Mm.
And I like exploration. So really, a list of ones I'm not involved in is probably shorter than a list of ones that I am involved in. I mean, certainly I was a founding shareholder of Alimental Altus, which is now progressed from being a prospect generator to being a royalty buyer. But Alpha Exploration, Royal Roads up in the Shield, a range of stuff in the DRC. I mean, I've been to the DRC a lot, so I always swallow twice before I do something there.
It's tricky, isn't it? Because the rate, you might lose the mining license, but you can kick the copper off the ground in that country.
You know what? Let's personalize it. Let's take Congo and me back to 1996.
Right.
That was a rough time there. They had a civil war where 2 million people died. So the realization of political risk was there. There was a little tiny TSX company called Tanke Mining, which controlled a deposit called Tanke Fungurume, which at that point in time was the biggest and best undeveloped copper deposit in the world, period, full stop.
Okay.
Two synclines, one Tanke, one Fungurume, an anticline between them that people suspected was mineralized. and the best copper deposit in the world was controlled by the Lundin family. I would argue the first family of mining finance in the world. The company had 30 cents a share cash in it, and it was selling for 19 cents a share. So I got the best copper deposit in the world with the best exploration developers in the world at a discount to cash.
Wow.
Only two things could happen. I could lose all my money, or I could get a re-rate to $5 or $6. And I decided to invest as much money as I could afford to lose 100% of, in hopes that the copper would last through the political madness. You know, that copper was probably in place 45 million years ago, and it has real patience for the stupidity of the people on top of it. And I was wrong. I thought the tank could go to $5 or $6. It went to $18 or $19.
Wow.
It didn't have to go that way. But a bet that's asynchronous enough that you buy 30 cents a share cash for 19 cents and you get the best copper deposit in the world and the best management team in the world thrown in for free is the sort of asymmetrical bet that a speculator has to bet. Move fast forward to, 8 years ago. Very smart private equity guys, Denham, old oil and gas guys, now in the mining business, backed some South Africans, and they made the best tin discovery in the world for 100 years in Alphaman.
Yeah, I know.
in the worst part of a very bad country.
Yeah.
North Kivu. And in order to develop the deposit, they had to throw some of the artisanal miners, it's a fancy way of saying militiamen, off the property. They had to run a road through 56 kilometers of bush in an area where people solve commercial disputes with 180 grains of lead.
Yeah.
They had to build this remote deposit, and then they had to move concentrate worth, at that point in time, $250,000 a truckload, now $400,000 a truckload, through some of the most dangerous terrain in the world.
They built it, now, though.
The first 3 or 4 years of that experience for me were bad. I was rewarded by my genius with a 80% decline in the share price.
Quite common, though, for that to happen before it shoots up.
Not uncommon. And now my annual dividends are something like 30% of the purchase price of my first shares.
Not bad going.
You know, again, I guess what a lot of investors look for is certainty. But I would suggest that certainty is never on offer. That you have to look at a range of probabilities. Sure. And when you have really asymmetrical bets, if you can psychologically and financially afford to take them, you have to take them.
There's a question for you, going back to copper. Zambia, is that where the next big tier one copper deposit is going to be found, do you reckon?
That I wish I knew.
You wish you knew.
I don't know. You know, when I was brought up in exploration, oil and gas exploration, my then boss, a wonderful mentor, said, Rick, you got to do things a little differently. You got to either employ new ideas in old places or old ideas in new places. But if you employ old ideas in old places, you're assuming that you're smarter than everybody who's gone before you, which is almost certainly wrong. So the idea that somebody in Zambia can, as an example, do what Robert Friedland did, go west on the Zambian belt under the Kalahari sands and discover copper that you couldn't kick, that you actually had to drill. I think the probability of that is high. The opportunity to explore horizons other than their own belt in the Zambian copper belt, I would suggest that that mineralizing event was so profound that there are horizons outside their own that will prove to be productive. But I don't know that the next tier one deposit won't be found in other hosts that are less well understood.
Just down the road from Robert Friedland's discovery there, you've got African Pioneer, Galileo, and Extract, all supposedly online towards the Angola border. And then Robert Friedland's bought everything over the other side of the Angola border. So do you have any comments on the land that those guys hold?
I don't, because it's too early on. What I've learned, though, is I don't have to buy the mystery. If somebody drills a discovery hole, and the price of the stock doubles, after they've drilled a discovery hole, the stock is probably worth 10 times as much.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
What I've learned
and
is
First Quantum are doing that at the minute with African Pioneer.
I mean, paying up for a discovery, particularly discovery with warts, and Congo's a big wart, is a really, really, really good deal. There have been times in my life when a stock has gone from 50 cents to a buck and a half on a drill hole, and I haven't bought it because it was already up. Almost every time, that's stupid. Really, truly stupid. If you have a sense from, as an example, auger drilling, what the size of the mineralized anomaly is, and then you get the third dimension and you get some grade, you have revalued in addition to repricing the company. If I were going to be more active in Southern African exploration, I would probably be active behind somebody like Royal Roads, a prospect generator. People who develop big geological concepts, staked the land, did the community work, did the government work, and then brought in joint venture partners, understanding that the probable result of any single exploration effort is failure. I would rather dilute myself at the project level than dilute myself at the knowledge level. That's extremely unpopular.
Yes, but I understand what you're saying. I mean,
but it's good arithmetic.
But we're all, you know, at the end of the day, we're, I think, as speculators, as you said the last time when we talked, that, you know, we are still dreaming that we want that 100 bagger, 200 bagger, and therefore I want to be in at the absolute root of when it could happen, you know. And, you know, if the geology is correct and, you know, Robert Friedland's discovered Kamoa and then subsequently moving down to the northwest Zambia there and into Angola, because he obviously believes it must carry on, then these three companies, African Pioneer, Galileo and Extract, with these licenses in between the licenses he's got, have got to be a good bet.
I think they're excellent exploration bets. I wish that given the size of their land package, they would do what Robert did and bring in deep-pocketed counterparties. What I don't want to see happen is I don't want to see these juniors spend their entire market cap developing a deposit developing an exploration thesis and then being unable to capitalize.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. And I think African Pioneer is one of them has brought in First Quantum. Correct. The problem is First Quantum's pockets have just been cut off, you know, literally by what's happened in Panama.
Yep.
So this has not helped the matter, obviously.
Okay, Rick, I want to ask you something a little bit closer to your home. The company Guardian Metal Resources, and they announced further drill hole assay results on their 100% owned Pilot Mountain project. Obviously, tungsten is the mineralized intersection there. So just talk us through what you think about that.
I don't know enough that I think my comments have value, so I'll duck that one.
Okay, but what about tungsten? What about tungsten as a mineral, though, in terms of, you know, as a defense? And then we've had China saying they've put export bans on antimony. Do you think it's a matter of time before they announce export bans on other minerals?
I don't think an export ban will matter. We've learned with American sanctions on the Russians, materials are fungible. You know, if they have a uranium ban, what'll happen is that the Russian uranium will go to China, and the Canadian and Australian uranium that goes to China will go to the U.S. So I don't care too much about that. I'm not disinclined to the idea that materials like vanadium, tungsten, antimony will benefit from geopolitical tension, because the leadership of Western countries will steal from their taxpayers to subsidize those businesses. So I'm not disinclined to that. And I'm, you know, Phil, I'm sort of agnostic about commodities, in the sense that a tier one discovery, a discovery with $10 billion at least in situ recoverable reserves and resources, irrespective of the commodity, will make you a boatload of money. And it will ultimately have to be bought for a major mining company, and almost always at an eye-popping premium. So, I mean, if somebody discovered an old covered lahar in Great Britain that was the biggest sand and gravel deposit in Great Britain and was within 100 kilometers trucking distance of London, I'd buy it.
Yes.
Tungsten?
Well, it's interesting with Guardian Metal Resources because you are heavily involved in that share through Power Metal Resources. It was a spin out from Power Metal Resources that then subsequently now they've got about 45%. But I think the interesting part about Guardian Metal Resources now is yes, the tungsten, but also very big quantity of silver involved by the looks of things. And more importantly, they've discovered a copper porphyry as well on Garfield. And all of this in Nevada. So give us your thoughts on Nevada as a place to invest in terms of mining. Is it a good place to invest in
Nevada is
or
still
not?
pretty good in the American context. It's still pretty good. The local politics are pretty good. The need for the state to steal mining revenues and tax is less extreme because they steal money from gamblers. There is a wonderful supply of miners in Nevada.
I think the gamblers give it up freely, even if they don't believe that when they first do it. But yes,
Well, I'm
I
talking about
well.
what happens after the casinos make it. The government steals an amazing amount from the casinos, but that's another
Isn't that the
discussion.
case of the mining as well? 90%, and it's also the same, the similar investing
Well, they're
gambling,
more
isn't it?
gentle with the miners than they otherwise would be. I think there's four jurisdictions in the U.S. Texas, Wyoming, Nevada, and Alaska that one can still do resource development in. Nevada also is well mineralized. It has a great, great, great mineral endowment. And I'm not anti-Guardian. What I'm trying to say is I don't know enough about the geology and enough about the results that I would want to burden your audience with my opinion.
Yes, no, I understand what you're saying. I think it has a lot of potential. One, I think you are more familiar with, and we're going across the world now, is back into Australia, and that was Greatland Gold, which was obviously part of this whole scenario where one big miner bought another big miner. So give us your thoughts on that one.
Well, disclosure of conflict. I'm still long Greatland. I've sold enough that I have no net present investment in it. It had spectacular share price performance 5, 6 years ago, and I harvested some of that. So my position stands me nothing, even after tax. I had expected, of course, that Newcrest would buy Greatland. I had expected that the consolidation would happen the other way around, that the shark would swallow the middle. It turns out that after all of these years of production, that the parent asset became viewed by the owner as a tier two asset, and the transaction took place the other way around. There's plenty of risks associated with this. Does the smaller management team at Greatland have either the financial or the technical capability to maximize whatever remaining value exists there? Do they have the financial strength to weather a mistake? Because all miners make a mistake at some point in time. I'm staying involved because the optionality, the size of the prize is spectacular. And I have been told by people who I would prefer not to name, Australians, that the asset in question was really milked for cash flow for five or 6 years, that there wasn't sufficient reinvestment of sustaining capital, and there wasn't sufficient love, care, and attention paid to it, and that there's a lot of low-hanging fruit left if the Greatland people have the discipline to do the requisite exploration work before they develop an overall operating plan for the district. This is something I've watched happen a lot in my life. I've watched it succeed, I've watched it fail, but I've watched new management teams come into an old asset that had been starved for cash and starved for love. And when the asset was believed to be long of tooth, simply the refocusing of a new management team that was willing to put millions in as opposed to take millions out has revitalized some old assets. And I'm hoping, because the Greatland guys, I think, are technically extremely creative, that we see a repeat of Northern Star here.
an interesting scenario, because I do think they're going to get cash flow, because even on surface, there's probably 500,000 ounces of gold there ready to be processed.
I think
And
that's
if
right.
they,
I think
you
you're
know,
treating the near term cash flow for the ultimate reclamation liability.
yeah, and
And the question is going to
but
be, is the net present value of the cash flow that you enjoy today worth the closure liability? That's going to come from integrating Greatland into the greater system, and really, really, really focusing on whatever low-hanging exploration development fruit exists there. My friend in Australia suggests that he believes, and he's a pretty good guy, he suggests that there's a minimum of 2.5 or 3 million ounces left in identifiable
In
leads
Telfer, yeah.
haven't been followed up on.
Yeah, and then you've got Havieron coming online in 2 years' time, or two and a bit years' time. So I think it could be the interesting thing is for me, Greatland Gold is, I think it could be a story where they could become the central player for that area, as in any exploration that's going on in and around it is going to be sort of almost like vacuum sucked into Telfer, and there's going to be some upside from those things, just like you had massive upside from Greatland Gold discovering Havieron in the first place. I think this is potentially possible. You've got
I agree with that completely.
Artemis Resources, I think it is. You know more about this than I do, Charles, but there's a few players around and about, which would be very interesting
You're
on.
trying to find the next, well, people say there isn't the next Greatland Gold. There 100% will be. Which one is it going to be? I think Artemis has got a great chance. But I mean, with Greatland's investment case, I mean, my perspective is you almost have this danger zone over the next 12 months or so, where they're obviously they have all the reward, but they have all the risk. So if something goes wrong early on, they need to be able to deal with it both technically and financially. But once they're generating that cash flow, then they'll be unstoppable. They will grow so fast.
They now have a very hungry mill, and the temptation is to mine and move marginal material to fill the mill. And I hope that they have the sophistication not to do that. The other thing that I think you have to look at with that acquisition is, if I'm right about the gold price, and I'm not saying I am, if I'm right about the gold price, that mine, even the residuals, will look very different at a higher gold price.
Well, the
Very, very, very
$10,000
different.
gold,
And
$1,500 all-in sustaining cost.
the
And an
optionality around
Australian
Telfer,
dollar gold price as well, which is looking very nice because of
the
the
optionality around
Australian
Telfer at
dollar.
higher gold prices is extraordinary because, it's clearly, if you look at the historic endowment, that's a tier one deposit by anybody's
Standard, yeah.
imagination.
Yeah. Rick, I just want to get you, before we wrap up, I want to just get your thoughts on something which I've noticed is basically, I think you've founded, is it Battlebank, this online only financial institution tailored for, high net worths and resource sector investors. But just talk us through the rationale behind this Battlebank, because it sort of intrigued me when I saw this news online.
Well, a couple of rationales. We built a bank similar to Battlebank beginning in 1998 called EverBank. And we had sort of a unique idea. The first idea was that we wouldn't have branches, that your phone or your computer was our branch. And that took out 1.5% of non-interest expense. In other words, we competed with the incumbents because our cost basis was lower. For those customers who weren't smart enough to use their phone, we didn't want them as customers. Leave the dumb people to Bank of America. We'll take the smart ones. And we grew that bank from zero to $28 billion before we sold the bank to TIAA CREF. TIAA CREF had a different customer base, and the products that made Battlebank so unique were abandoned after we'd spent 14 years building up a 275,000 customer base. They abandoned our customers. So Battlebank is all about
Doesn't
going
that
out
sound,
and
that's
getting our
just
customers.
how it goes every time.
They took
That's it.
over Telfer and closed it by the sounds of it.
We had a unique proposition. Rather than having 15 deposit products, five of which paid you no interest, we have one deposit product, a high yield money market account. You can write checks on it. There's an awful lot of money on deposit in the United States for no interest, which is pretty stupid. We went after that money once before and got it, and we're going to go after it again. The second thing that we do differently is we allow Americans to save in many currencies, not just the U.S. dollar. At EverBank, I think we had certificates of deposit available in 28 currencies. We'll start Battle Bank with having certificates of deposits in 18 currencies. The thing that will interest you guys the most, I think, is on the other side of the balance sheet, on the asset side. Right now, there's $33 billion in gold and silver bullion in segregated accounts in the United States. And there's no bankers, to my knowledge, that believe that gold is good security. The idea that I can take as collateral somebody's gold or silver that they have at Brinks, Loomis, or Viamat, where I control the security and I can lend the money at a 50% loan to value on bullion, that's the best business I've ever heard of.
Sounds good.
I know how to talk to that audience.
So they can effectively people.
When we started EverBank, when we started EverBank, we had a customer backlog of zero and we grew it to $28 billion. At Battle Bank, our customer backlog exceeds 15,000, 50% of whom have experienced interest, in what is in effect a margin loan on physical gold and silver in safe storage. It's
Sounds
nice
like
to have this sort
loan.
Of opportunity available to me in my 70s.
Rick, one of the things we do every year is we do 12 stocks of the next year, so 12 stocks of 2025. Okay, so I want to invite you now that towards the end of the year we do this again, and right. maybe you come back with let's say 3, 4, 5 or stocks which you think in 2025 are going to perform, and it'd be really good for our audience initially anyway if the majority of them were UK stocks. How do you feel about that? Do you think you could come up with that?
I'll try. At some point in time, when you think it would be germane to have me back, I'll decide if I have 3 or 4 UK stocks that I know enough about to comment on.
Yeah. We'll probably do it sometime in December. Anyway, this is when we normally do our thing. And
Great.
Then we have 12 stocks of Christmas, if you like, and then we have 5 gold rings, which is basically what we think is the total speculation. So maybe you can have a couple of speculative ones and three that you think are solid investments. But it's been absolutely, it's been fascinating talking to you again. And from the last time we spoke, we did speak, gold was likely to be on the increase. Let's hope it's going to continue. But as a last comment, somebody commented to me, is it true that the Canadian gold miners or gold companies have had quite a run in the last few months?
The higher quality ones, the ones that have deserved to run, interestingly enough. Agnico Eagle, who's kept their costs under control, despite the fact that it's a big company, up 40%.
So these are all producers, are they, rather than explorers?
The high quality explorers have been on a tear. Understand that most of the Canadian explorers are valueless. I would suggest to you that 85% of Canadian junior listings have no value whatsoever. And they're tending towards their intrinsic value, which is zero. The market is decoupling, as it should. The high-quality companies are raising scads of money and developing bids after the financing. They're doing well. The length and breadth of the Canadian market is where it deserves to be, which is to say in the sewer.
Rick Rule, thanks very much for appearing.
Thank you.
Bye.
So let's have a look at some of the movers and shakers of this week. We've had Energy Pathways, probably about the best performer. They're up some 138%, 140%. So they moved from around the sort of 4.5 pence mark at the beginning of the week, and they closed on Friday at 8.2 pence. So great to see them, obviously, on the news related to the government projects there, been selected, collaboration with the government. We interviewed Ben Klug in the week, the CEO, and it was very interesting talking to him. I think that company is definitely poised to move or continue moving up. What did you make of that news in the week?
Well, I think that, you know, the energy security, energy infrastructure, the Labour government, whether, you know, regardless of whether you support them or not, they're going to invest hugely in this area. So in some ways, Energy Pathways, right time, right place. In some ways, just being lucky, you know, the investment's going to come in at this time. But also they're capitalizing on it. it's run properly. They've got a plan, and I suspect it's after such a large rise, there may be profit taking. But in terms of sort of a 3 to 5 year investment, I think they're going to do really well. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that they've had effectively this loan facility, which looked like it's been negotiated on very favorable terms. But the latest news was related to the Department of Energy Security and Net Zero. DESNZ had invited Energy Pathways company to participate in the hydrogen storage business model HSBM, which is design group, comprises of a select number of companies, including these several tier one companies that are at the forefront of the UK's energy transition. So, but yeah, it looks interesting. I mean, it'd be interesting to see what the shortlisting process is. But I think the government is aiming to achieve this. It's a UK ambition to achieve like 10 gigawatt of low carbon hydrogen production
Yeah,
by
by
2030.
2030, yeah.
But what they're going to do is, it's interesting, like when the wind's blowing or not blowing, and effectively they're going to take the hydrogen, that's the green hydrogen, and they're going to push it back through into the national grid to effectively decarbonize the fuels that are there. So it's interesting how it's all going to work.
Yeah, I think the government is just going to throw money at it. And in terms of hydrogen projects, there's very few companies with one. It's as simple as that. So I think that when it comes to talking to these kind of tier one companies that they're also talking to, it may be the case that there'll be some kind of strategic investment into Energy Pathways in the near future. And I don't know whether Ben's alluded to that at all, but I suspect he has to you.
So, anything else, Charles? I mean, I think a couple of yours have moved, some of your favourites. We saw Rome Resources up around the 30%. Just talk us through that news.
Yeah, so Rome obviously did its RTO back in July, and then now since then they've had four diamond drill rigs going. We're now going to start getting assays back very shortly, and this is one of these companies where it's in the DRC, so there's jurisdictional risk, even though you have the chairman Klaus Ekhof is able to deal with it. But the mineralization there is just absolutely fantastic. They're looking for tin, they're looking for copper, they're looking for silver, they're looking for zinc. And they're going to find it. It's right next to Alphamin's Busy deposit, where they're searching Busy North. And yeah, I mean, this is one of my favorite stocks this year, and I think it's just going to rise and rise.
Just
They'll
talk
get
about
it.
the
Go
rebranding,
on.
because I think this was originally a company called Pathfinder Minerals from memory. Just talk us through what happened in terms of going into Rome Resources.
Well, it's just a standard RTO, effectively. I mean, they needed to raise. I think they raised £4 million back in July. To keep do the diamond drilling campaign on Busy North. They raised the money, and now the drilling they're doing is going to cost roughly half of that capital. So they're fully cashed up and ready to go. We'll get a maiden resource estimate hopefully in Q1 next year, early Q1, and then I'm hoping for an asset sale as soon as soon after as that, and then 6 8 months, and then you're done. Fantastic.
Great.
Yeah, and then yeah, it is just one of those quick, really good, decent plays that hopefully. We'll just make everyone a lot of money.
Yeah.
Fingers
Well,
crossed.
yeah, absolutely. Then there was obviously ARC Minerals as well. We saw some news from them. Actually, we didn't see any news, did we? It's moved. I had it effectively rewrite. Just talk us through what we've seen on ARC Minerals this week.
So with ARC Minerals in Botswana, their Virgo license, which is effectively surrounded by MMG's Khoemacau licenses. We are getting 562 kilograms of materials being assayed by ALS in Johannesburg, and those assays are expected to come back relatively soon. Well, indeed early next week, and then when those assays come, that because there's visible chalcocite in the material, there's a lot of hope for that. And then at the same time, the assays in Zambia, the joint venture of Anglo American, we're hoping for those to come back as well. So it might be that the next couple of weeks are going to be transformative for the company. So the share price is just shooting up in anticipation. But again, we're at the mercy of the drill bit, even though there's so much to be analyzed and to come back in the next couple of weeks.
One of the things that Rick talked about there as well, or that we talked about with Rick, sorry, was the copper. And one
Yeah.
of the most exciting is the wrong word, but one of the plays that I think really has a chance of having a lot of momentum over the next period of time is Bazant Resources. Now that they've finally got this license in Namibia for Hope and Gorup. I just want people to understand that this has the potential for 190,000 tons of contained copper, and the gold credit. And I just want you to think about that in the context of how much in-ground value that actually is. And that's not the total game. That's just what has been jorked. The reality is there's a 14-kilometer strike here. It's in the middle of, it sounds crazy, in the middle of the desert, but I mean, it is a desert. We've visited it. It's not far from the coast. It's only about 20 kilometers from the coast. Has a railway line there, has processing facilities there. If you Google Earth it, you'll see it.
Yeah.
And it has a railway line also from African Pioneers Ongombo plant as well, which is near Windhoek. You know, all of a sudden, there is a big issue with Colin Bird's companies in that particular situation in Namibia to have a producing copper mine probably within 12 to 18 months. And I don't think that's over-egging it.
It could even be quicker than that,
it
honestly,
be
because
quicker.
You're just developing open pit and sending it to a processing plant. I mean, we already, I mean, I did the back of a bag packet math, so we're talking sort of $10 to $15 million. That's US dollars capex. And then $20 million free cash flow, you know, potentially as soon as June next year. So, yeah, I mean, in terms of the profit you can make, and then obviously the exploration potential as well, it's absolutely massive. And then, you know, you mentioned Colin, obviously the Collins company, but also, you know, today, Galileo Resources, you know, a second mining license for Lansome in Zambia. So it seems to finally, for Colin, after, you know, a few years not, you know, of the company is not doing as well as they should, it's all coming together at the same time for all of them. And it's going to be really exciting. You know, I had a conversation with him recently, and for the first time in a long time, he seems genuinely excited about the entire stable. Do you get that sense from him when you speak
to
him?
No, absolutely. And Extract's in the same boat as well. Extract with Silver King in Zambia. The money's still coming in from the gold. And, you know, other licenses being added in Zambia. One just across the road from Lewansobe. You know, now there's some legal situations going on with that one, but if resolved, all of a sudden that could be not a second Lewansobe, but it, you know, it's similar in terms of its size and possible propensity to hit. Well, there's copper there, let's put it that way. Okay, it has been drilled historically and there is copper there. So you've got Extract, you've got Galileo, you've now got Byzant, with a mining license, you've got African Pioneer with a mining license in Namibia, you've got African Pioneer with the joint venture with First Quantum, you've got Extract with a license online there as well, you've got Galileo, and these are all in northwest Zambia, in the thing that we discussed with Rick. So the optionality for all of those four companies is now like huge. It really is huge.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And I think it's one of those scenarios that if one of them hits, I think they could all explode, you know, because but for me, if you take the exploration side of things out, okay, you've got Galileo, who could basically start an open pit in Lewansobe, and you've got Byzant that could start an open pit in Hope and Garb.
Yeah, exactly.
So those two companies now are looking at it, and you're saying to yourself, well, within 18 months, let's say 24 months, and as you say, it could be much sooner, those guys could be, you know, Byzant has a £4 million market cap, and you just said it's got £20 million worth of revenue, or $20 million dollars of revenue.
Close enough.
Are you talking about that free cash flow, or is that
free cash flow? Free cash flow.
You know,
flow.
That's free cash flow. That's five times its current market cap, and that's every
crazy,
year for another
it?
20, 30 years, probably.
And then on top of that, you know, Kev, I mean, you've got like Midnight Sun, ASX listed, or ARC Minerals. You've got these other sort of like, you know, companies that are exploring, you know, Zambia, Botswana, Namibia. And any one of them comes up with a decent deposit, and then everything in the region will shoot up, right?
Yeah.
But you've got
You saw sniffins with ARC this week, didn't we? We saw
it
go above 2p.
Well, we're getting assays back from Botswana and from Zambia, hopefully both of them next week. And the hopes are really high for both of them. But this is the thing, right? Okay, yes, it'll be fantastic for ARC, but also all of these other sort of juniors in the region, people go, hang on, this should not have a £3-4 million market cap if you've got a massive
No.
amount of copper and there's a pathway to production slash sale to one of the majors. I mean, we know the majors are around Bezant, around African Pioneer, around Galileo. It won't be long, I suspect, until somebody goes, hang on, it will be so much cheaper to just buy these licenses than pick a version license that we don't have information on and explore it. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're already going to
Yeah,
put
for
100
sure.
million into the ground, why would you not go for somebody who's already done all the surface exploration? And bear in mind, I mean, Colin has drilled, in terms of the amount of drilling that's been done by his stable of companies, it is more drilling than pretty much anybody else in terms of pounds invested into the ground per meter. Very efficient as well. So yeah, I think it's going to 2025 is going to be the year where I think they'll all come back. And Zambia and Botswana, those two, and Namibia, those three locations in particular. I mean, when we were talking to Rick, he effectively said it. It's impossible to develop a mine really in the Western world, in North America and
Yeah.
Australia. It's 26, 30 years to get anything online. If you're in, Southern Africa, 5, 6 years, you can be up and running a major tier one deposit. And the smaller, the mid-tier ones, you can be doing it inside 12 months. So, yeah.
Yeah. No, I think one of the things that we got from the last trip to Zambia was there is a real opportunity for slightly smaller copper deposits, whether that be 20,000 tons, 50,000 tons, 100,000 tons, 200,000 tons. These are real money makers, and there are plenty of them all over Zambia. I think the same in Botswana. Congo seems to be elephant country, as in, you don't find a small amount, you find huge amounts. So yeah, it's like who knows? But I mean, it was great talking. What did you think of the chat with Rick? I thought it was really good.
I thought it was good. I think it's nice to get his sort of his overall perspective of the world, right? Of US
Yeah.
politics and money, mining in general. And like he yeah, this is the thing, right? It's the wisdom of a man in his 70s who's made loads of money in the sector, right? While
Yeah.
he's around and happy to come on here and talk to us about it, and we can ask him anything we want, take advantage of it.
Yeah,
I mean,
no, and he's
he's a
been
funny chap
around
as
in other
well.
situations, isn't it? I mean, when you hear him say, like, in the 1970s, this happened, and then even in the 2000s, when Zambia, Congo all decided, hey, give us the mines back, sort of thing, and then realized they'd made an immense boo-boo, and then realized that they needed the outside world to help them, so they've hopefully not going to make the same mistakes again, but yeah,
No.
we will see.
On Tuesday of this week, I paid a visit to Celadon Pharmaceuticals' state-of-the-art cultivating facility in the Midlands, and I had a guided tour and met CEO James Short, and this is what he had to say.
Okay, so here I am with James Short, CEO of Celadon Pharmaceuticals at the Midlands Cultivation Facility. I want to start, James, by just saying thanks for showing me around today. It's been a real eye-opener. But so we've seen obviously the phase one facility, and I've had a look around the phase two, which obviously is work in progress. But just talk the listeners through what we've seen today so far.
Yeah, thanks for coming through, Phil. Yeah, so phase one, you've seen it, you've been in the grow rooms, you can see the level that we're producing the product at. And I know I've constantly said to you all year, you've got to come up, you've got to see it. Seeing is believing, but you now, I hope, understand some of the IP that we've been developing over the last 4 years to produce product at that level. Everybody's got this notion that you're just growing a cannabis plant, it's easy because people can grow it in a terraced house. You've seen the clear difference to the level that we're at. And that's demonstrated in the deal that we did in Denmark, where they're paying us for access to our IP. Now, what we're going to do is expand that into our phase two. So, as I've said before, phase one is sold out, the product for the next 3 years. We now have demand for more product. as you've seen in phase two, all the building work's finished, the construction's up, 95% of the build work's finished. We just now have to finish fitting out the lights, et cetera. Once that comes online, that should generate us roughly 30 million a year, between 65% and 70% EBIT. So huge opportunity for us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I must admit, I'm blown away by the scale of operations. Even, as you say, just phase one itself is a remarkable, and the technology that goes into the whole cultivation is mind-blowing. I couldn't even begin to start to imagine the research and, as you say, IP that's gone in. And I think a lot of listeners and maybe investors don't understand that Celadon isn't just a growing company like you see there, as you say, growing it in someone's loft. This is a fully kitted out company that they're using effectively a pharmaceutical element for the IP and the technologies that go into that. So I think that that's massively missed. But so just talk us through the sort of the next steps. Obviously, phase two, we've seen this a big facility, but how much of a scale up from phase one in terms of output will that give you over the existing infrastructure?
If we look at it in monetary terms, we'll go from about 1.5 million up to 30 million pounds sterling Wow. per annum. So it's a big scale up. But, you know, a lot of the market, as you said, don't realise the level of what we're doing it at. You know, and I get a lot of comments that, you know, your burn rate's high, et cetera, et cetera. But what we've been developing over the past 4 or 5 years, you've now seen it first hand, Phil.
Yeah.
You can't do that on a shoestring.
No.
You know, we don't burn money. You've seen how we're very, very lean. And that's now starting to pay off, i.e. with the Danish deal, that they're paying us now for access to our IP at £1.5 million a year for the next 5 years, is starting to pay off. And we've got lots of other companies in different parts of the world want to access what we've got.
Yeah, very good. So I'm just looking at this, a device on the table, effectively a nebulizer. It's a small box. You put in a cartridge with a flower in it. Just talk us through exactly what that is. And this is related to these NHS, these LVL trials.
Yeah, so LVL stands for level, which is what all doctors want to get the patients with chronic pain. It's the only UK government-approved trial. We bought 55% of it 3 years ago, I think it was. We now own 100% of that company. It is now fully approved. When I say fully approved, what we had to do was do a little baby step before the government had approved it, and we had to get 100 patients over a three-month period, which we did. We got some fantastic results. We RNS'd the results. We got York University to study those, and we RNS'd that back end of last year. So we're now ready to go and launch that next year. The idea then is we launch that in the UK. It will then give us access to up to 5,000 patients. It'd take me pretty much all day to explain all the benefits,
yeah.
But the key thing is we think it's one of the ones that will certainly help open up the UK market for medical cannabis. We have ideally positioned for it. It'll be a Celadon product, Celadon on it, the data we'll get back.
Yeah.
You know, the added value that Celadon will gain for that over the next coming years are insurmountable.
Yeah. I think you were going through some of the potential numbers in terms of how much the facility can do at the full phase, you know, through to phase three build out. And it was something around the 50,000 mark in terms of patients itself. But then I asked, what is the market? And you said something around 3 million, but that was just of numbers that they, you know, there's other numbers on top of that that they could go. So just talk about how big the market is.
Yeah, so the numbers, and they're constantly changing, but they're, you know, these are NHS, these are government numbers saying there's around 7 million people with pain in the UK. Now that could be higher, it could be lower. We suspect it's going to be higher.
Sure.
Of which 3 million of those, the government is saying, are eligible for a cannabinoid, meaning they've tried every other form of medication.
Yeah.
So now they need something alternative, which is potentially a cannabinoid. So if you think there's 3 million potential patients within chronic pain, our facility, fully operational, fast forward 12 months, 2 years, we could only produce enough product for around 50 to 60,000 patients.
Yeah.
But to put that in perspective, that gives us a 90 million revenue at a 65 to 70% EBIT. It's just, yeah. And people say, what about competition? Well, the market opportunity is huge for us in the UK. You know,
yeah. You
need many more Celadons to even scratch the surface of
the
opportunity in the UK.
Yeah, the market is big enough for many different Celadons, or as you say, you know, many build outs potentially.
Yeah, now investors get a bit nervous of that, saying, well, you know, there's Canadians that'll come in, there's Spain, they'll fetch product in. But it's We spent 80 years stopping narcotics coming into the country, and so have every other country. So moving a narcotic across borders is super hard. We know it because we've been shipping it into America, into Europe. It's super hard. And that's why we wanted to do the deal in Denmark, so we don't have to move our product from England to Germany. Yeah. We just send the cuttings, do our IP, grow it in Denmark to supply to Germany. Yeah. It's costly and it's a nightmare. Yeah. So we believe that if we can produce products in England for the British market, it will allow the regulators to not be importing products into the UK. It's a real problem fetching product in to the country. Absolutely. So we're ideally positioned to go and capture that ever-expanding market in the UK.
Brilliant. All sounds very good. And as I say, once again, Jim, I really appreciate you showing me around. I didn't think I'd be, you know, gowned up going around the facility, but going into some of the growing rooms, it was a real experience and an eye-opener. So I just want to say, Jim Short, CEO of Celladon Pharmaceuticals, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for coming through again, Phil.
Okay, well, I think we've talked long enough there. It's been an action-packed show. I want to say thanks to Rick Rule, CEO of Rule Investment Media, and obviously thanks a lot, Charles, our resident analyst and investor. And I want to say thanks for listening to all the listeners and viewers at home. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe, hit the bell icon, then you receive any further notifications of any future episodes. Have a great weekend all.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.